KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Outer Mission.
I live in the Nastro.
I live in the Mistro.
La Playa.
Coming up, we'll talk to a doctor about the lingering health effects of the North Bay fires.
This wildfire really was somewhat of a public health emergency affecting millions and millions of people in the Bay Area.
Then we'll answer a Hey Area question about the crane in San Francisco's Hunter's Point.
So it has become a photogenic icon of our city, one of the many weird objects.
But what was it for and where did it come from? And then we'll hear a story of how a community came together to make San Francisco's Bayview more beautiful.
There was a lot of dead grass, weeds. It had all kinds of debris.
Stick around, Cross Currents is next. The destructive wildfires that raged through Northern California over the last couple of weeks burned close to 250,000 acres of land, forced 100,000 people to evacuate their homes, and tragically took the lives of 42 people. Air quality became a major concern for people, not just near the flames, but up to 100 miles away. Now, questions remain about the longer-term health effects of all that smoke and ash. KALW's Jen Chien brought some of those questions to Dr. Robert Blount, an assistant professor of pulmonary medicine at UCSF. As a lung specialist, his research focus is on air pollution health effects. He spoke to us from his office in San Francisco.
What are some of the toxins that are in the wildfire smoke? And then also with these recent fires, a lot of buildings also burned. So what kinds of stuff is in the air then?
When the building goes up in smoke and the brush and the trees, all of those chemicals that are involved in that combustion process then can adhere to the tiny particles. So that you have chemicals coming from the building, such as from paint, so volatile organic compounds, heavy metals, a lot of different things that can be toxic to human health. The most dangerous form of this air pollution is called fine particulate matter. And so that's about the size of a bacteria or even less. And the reason this particular size of pollution is really dangerous is that it can get inhaled deeply into the lungs and they can go a long ways, whereas the heavier particles will fall out closer to the site of the fire.
Well, we know that the air quality was extremely bad in a lot of places in the Bay Area recently, but how many days in a row does it need to be that bad to have long-term health effects?
The good news is that that a short exposure, such as the one we encountered here in the Bay Area, which is ranging from 1 to 2 weeks, is not thought to carry with it long-term consequences. It's unlikely that these levels are going to lead to long-term negative consequences in a person's health. It's when people are exposed repeatedly to high levels over time, for months on end and years on end, that really they develop more chronic effects.
I see. But how long does it take to recover from a short-term exposure? How long might it affect you?
It depends on the person. A young to middle-aged adult who is healthy is likely to pull through this pretty well. A lot of us who were exposed to some of the smoke would have some itchy eyes, watery eyes, scratchy throat, a cough here and there, and that would be the end of it. When the skies cleared, everything was fine. Now, the people that had a harder time during these high pollution days with the wildfire are those children and adults with pre-existing lung or heart conditions. These air pollutants can cause a lot of breathing problems. They can also irritate the heart and result in heart attacks and stroke. And these are immediate effects.
Do we know anything in terms of research done about the long-term health effects on the exposed communities to these kinds of fires? So folks in Santa Rosa or people very, very close or in the path of the fires?
It's felt at this point, you know, that that a single fire episode or an annual, you know, a seasonal fire where there's going to be increased smoke exposure, even people in Santa Rosa, as long as that pollution passes and it's the long-term effects are probably not going to be great. Now, certainly people who are caught in very close proximity to the fire could have inhalational injuries, things like that, to direct contact with smoke. But that's kind of a different category of health complication from exposure. Most of us, even in the surrounding areas of the fire, it's going to be mainly just this really thick, smoky, smoke-filled air pollution condition.
So does having your car's air conditioning set to the recirculated mode really help in times of great air pollution?
It depends somewhat on the quality of the filter. Now, an even better method would be having a HEPA filter inside the house.
After the rain of last week, the air just smelled so much better immediately. When that happens, is the air really cleaner, or is that more of a perception bias going on?
Yeah, so in the case of wildfire, we can really use our sense of smell and sight pretty effectively. So when we smell smoke in the air, or see that smoky haze in the air, it's a really pretty good indication that the air pollution levels are high. And the opposite of that is also true. When we really smell that the air is fresh again and we don't smell that smoky smell, it's a good indication that things have cleared up. And it's important, like, for people to realize that, because in these last couple of weeks with the wildfire, the air conditions changed quite dramatically in some places. And it was the air quality was quite localized. So some neighborhoods had much better air than others. So keeping that in mind during wildfire is good. You can really smell it. And if you can really smell it, that's a good chance to either wear the mask or to get inside if you can.
So what is your best advice then? Or is there anything else we should know to keep us and our lungs healthier now or in future wildfire seasons?
Having N95 masks available, I think, is one really good suggestion. So then you can limit the amount of exposure, because the N95 mask is designed to filter out the majority of the fine particulate matter in the air. For people with pre-existing lung and heart conditions, making sure that they have an inhaler available if that has been prescribed to them. This fire took us all by surprise on Sunday night. What was it, a week and a half ago? One of our big concerns as scientists and doctors is that of global warming, because we feel that with global warming, and there's good evidence to support that, that the number and intensity of extreme weather events is just going to get worse and worse. So as the extremes get more and more extreme, that makes us more susceptible to events such as the wildfire. And this wildfire really was somewhat of a public health emergency affecting millions and millions of people in the Bay Area. So my bigger concern and over time is with global warming.
That's Dr. Robert Blount, a doctor of pulmonary medicine at UCSF. He spoke with KLW's Jen Chien. You can find all our coverage of the North Bay fires at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Drive over the Bay Bridge, and it's impossible to miss all the cranes along the shore, busily working in the Port of Oakland. But over in San Francisco, there's this one solitary crane that hasn't been used in years, the Hunter's Point crane. Craig Peterson works on Bayshore Boulevard, not far from the KALW studios. And every time he looks out the window of his office, he has this great view of that massive crane. When he sees it, it often raises a question, which he then put to Hey Area, our collaborative reporting project.
Hey Area, what's the true story behind the Hunter's Point crane?
Well, we sent KALW's Stephen Short to see if he could find an answer.
Hi, are you Craig?
Stephen, how are you doing?
Okay, good. Oh, and there's that view of the crane.
Yep, I've been looking at that for 15 years.
It's a couple of miles away, driving distance, but the Hunter's Point crane is eye level from Craig's fourth floor window. It's been there since 1947, when it was known as the mightiest crane in the world. Craig remembers a former coworker who he describes as a crusty old ex-army guy,
who told me that this was one of two cranes at the time, the largest in the world, built by the Germans. And as reparations after the war, the Russians got one of the two and we got the other.
My first inclination was to find more about the crane's history from the vast pool of Bay Area historians. That's where I found Chris Carlson, co-director of foundsf.org. Chris says the part about the Hunter's Point crane being the mightiest in the world at the time is true. As for us getting this as part of the spoils of World War II...
I can't even remotely believe that has any veracity, and the reason is pretty obvious.
But before we get to that, let's get to know this crane better.
This strange device, this strange object that sits at the shoreline and dominates the view anytime you're looking towards the southeast of San Francisco and out across the bay.
It dominates the view because it's 450 feet high. That's about 150 feet taller than the Statue of Liberty. Also, it's 730 feet long, only about 150 feet shorter than the Titanic. But what was this massive crane supposed to do? Why is it there?
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air.
Well, when Pearl Harbor happened, the Navy moved quickly to take over the entire Hunter's Point dry docks, which had been there since the 1860s.
A dry dock is a space that can be drained of water to allow the inspection and repair of a ship's hull. Hunter's Point was the first permanent dry dock on the West Coast. After expanding in 1916, it was considered to be the largest dry dock in the world. Chris says the crane was constructed in the late 1940s to maintain battleships that would become known as the Pacific Fleet.
It was capable of lifting whole warships out of the sea.
It's reported that the crane could lift 630 tons. That's approximately 28 warships.
So that's part of why it was built, was so they could actually do maintenance on the hulls of ships and lift and drop very, very, very large, heavy objects in and out of the water.
The entire Hunter's Point shipyard was decommissioned in 1974, and the massive crane has stood idle ever since. As to why Chris the historian is so sure that the crane is not German, he says,
we had a massive steel industry at that time here in California. Even in San Francisco, there was a large steel factory of U.S. Steel.
But Craig Peterson, our Hay Area questioner, isn't buying it.
Well, is it theoretically possible that it was actually fabricated and installed in Germany, and as war reparations after the war was disassembled, brought to the United States?
Theoretically, yes. But to find the definitive answer, I had to make a call to our nation's capital.
The crane was built specifically for the shipyard.
Paul Taylor is branch head for communication at the Naval History and Heritage Command.
I think the caller seems to be confusing the Hunter's Point crane with another crane called YD-171, which was euphemistically known as Herman the German. That crane was brought from Germany and reassembled in the United States at Long Beach, California, at about the same time as the crane at Hunter's Point was built.
So, Hunter's Point crane, definitely made in the USA. I visited Craig once again, and we stood in his office looking at the crane as I gave him the news.
So your man was right. Herman the German was dismantled from Germany, brought to the United States, but not here.
Fascinating. That is interesting.
So you accept that answer?
I do accept that, yeah. I think that's... I'm glad that the story was at least half true.
Okay, good.
I really appreciate it. And I've got other questions, too.
More questions? Maybe we'll call in the Marines for those. In Hunter's Point, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
If you've got a question for Hey Area, you can go to klw.org and fill out the Hey Area form, and we'll see if we can answer it for you. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. A short drive away from the Crane in San Francisco's Bayview District, you'll find a neighbor-led volunteer group that's been bringing greenery and camaraderie to traffic islands and empty lots in the neighborhood for over a decade. It's the Quesada Gardens Initiative. Over the weekend, we heard of the passing of one of the group's co-founders, Jeffrey Betcher. He was a tireless community advocate who was executive director for many years, and his house on Quesada Street was the center of many of the project's activities. Back in 2013, KLW's Jen Chien made a piece about Quesada Gardens as part of our Sights and Sounds of Bayview project. Let's take a listen.
Look at that. Ooh-wee, that's pretty.
Like many people who see a pretty rose in bloom, Annette Smith likes to take in the sight and scent of it. But her enjoyment of this particular rose bush in this particular garden comes with a deeper meaning.
That was one that Chris Montgomery gave us.
Annette knows the stories behind most of the plants growing in the Quesada Gardens project, which is on the median strip of Quesada Avenue off of busy 3rd Street and the Bayview. The mostly single-family houses on either side of the street face lush greenery, flowers, and even some fruits and vegetables. But Annette remembers what it was like before it was a garden.
Oh, yes, it was a lot of dead grass, weeds. It had all kinds of debris.
Annette moved onto this block in the late 90s. Her brother, who was already there, told her about an apartment opening near him. Back then, the median strip was bare, except for garbage. The block was also at that time a hub for a bustling drug trade, with the violence, prostitution, and despair that often goes along with it.
Anytime day or night, you see somebody walking along like zombies because they were so out of it.
Annette says that toxic atmosphere left a lot of people afraid to come outside. That's how things were when Jeffrey Betcher moved onto the street, a little after Annette did. Although some of Jeffrey's friends were worried for him, a gay white man moving into historically black Bayview, he says his race and sexual orientation were never an issue. His problem was the same one Annette described.
People were living in isolation. They were fearful. I was. We all were.
Jeffrey moved in next door to Annette's brother, Woody, and that's how the two met. They hit it off from the start. One day in early 2002, Jeffrey came home from work to find that something was different about the median in front of his house. Woody Smith had dug up a patch of grass, looking for worms to use as fishing bait, and Annette had felt bad about the mess he'd made. So she and another neighbor, Carl Page, decided to take advantage of the turned earth and planted some collard greens, and then some flowers.
I felt that the flower would look better than the dirt out there that he had dug up.
Soon, Annette and Carl were gardening every day, and the median started to look a little brighter. Jeffrey says it wasn't long before other neighbors started coming outside to ask about what was happening, and then they started to pitch in. Some had experience with gardening and dug right in. Others hung out and gave moral support through conversation or just a thumbs up as they drove past. People on the block were seeing something they hadn't seen before, right outside their front doors.
And these smiling faces and people not afraid to give people hugs and shake hands, and that changed the world very quickly.
So Annette and Carl gardened in little plots along the median for about a year, helped along by Jeffrey and others, all on an ad hoc basis. Then, in 2003, a meeting took place on Quesada Avenue. A group of about 30 residents got together in one neighbor's backyard to talk about what was going on the block. Jeffrey says he thought for sure the drug dealing was going to be everyone's top issue. But some people thought that rats were a more pressing problem, or the recent surge in mosquitoes.
The one thing that we could agree on was that there was already beauty and strength here in this community, and Carl and Annette were showing us that in the garden.
They chose the name Quesada Gardens Initiative at that first meeting. Well, actually, they chose the name Quesada Gardens Initiative. Although it's a Spanish street name, historically there weren't a lot of Spanish speakers in the neighborhood, so some of the locals pronounce it differently. Neighbors started bringing plants from their own backyards to the garden, and there were donations from nurseries.
A whole lot of different plants, flowers, shrubbery.
Jeffrey had experience in nonprofit administration, so he started doing things like working on the organization's tax status and getting the attention of media and funders. There was some initial resistance from city officials who seemed wary of unsanctioned items being placed on city land, but they soon came around when they saw the value the gardens brought to the block.
They didn't have to send anybody out there to cut the grass or anything because we were doing all the work.
And the beautification of the physical space helped to fill in something that had been missing from the block before.
And for me, it was knowing my neighbors, busting through that isolation.
The effects of the garden also spread to other parts of the neighborhood. Joel and Mary McClure live a short distance up the hill from the Quesada Gardens on Bridgeview Street. They have a great view from their house, but right outside their living room window was an empty lot owned by the city. Here's Mary.
People would use it as a trash dump.
From their outdoor deck, the McClures could see the swaying palms and blooming flowers of the Quesada Gardens.
So you would see all this beauty on this side, and then we would go to the other side of our house, and you would just see this horrible weed-infested lot. And then finally we just said, that's it, we gotta do something, and it's gonna be us.
The McClures were able to secure permission, assistance, and a water source from the city. But Joel says he was mostly inspired by the do-it-yourself attitude of the Quesada Gardens neighbors.
Can't also always keep asking the government to do things for us, specifically when it's right there in our backyard.
So the McClures, their neighbors, and some dedicated student volunteers got to work turning the trash-filled lot into a terraced garden, much of it producing fruits and vegetables for the neighbors. Mary and Joel say they enjoy the gardening, but what they get out of it is something bigger.
Quite honestly, up until about 2003, we didn't really know any of our neighbors, and we'd been in our house for like 3 years.
One of the neighbors Mary met was 10-year-old Serenity Williams, who lives across the street on Bridgeview.
I was at home, I looked out the window, and I saw people working in the garden, and I asked my mom, can I help? And then Mary said, yes.
Serenity started gardening every week. Her favorite task is watering the plants. Jeffrey Betcher says he feels a real sense of safety on his block now, and that he can't imagine living anywhere else.
People respond differently to everything when they're on a block where they have a sense that people know one another, people are looking out for each other.
At this point, the Quesada Gardens Initiative projects include 2 murals, 6 community gardens throughout the neighborhood, and Bayview Footprints, a weekly newsletter that highlights good news in the neighborhood.
We're trying to do good things and trying to pass it on to the next block so they can do good things for them to pass it on.
And though about half the homes on that first block of Quesada have changed residence since Annette and Carl planted those first collard greens, the spirit of neighborliness and safety they helped to foster has continued to grow and bloom. In Bayview Hunters Point, I'm Jen Sheehan for Cross Currents.
That piece was produced in 2013 as part of our Sights and Sounds of Bayview project in partnership with the SF Arts Commission. Jeffrey Betcher passed away on Saturday after a long illness. Last December, Jeffrey wrote an essay in a neighborhood newsletter. We'd like to share some of his words with you. He wrote, "I've come to think that a person with a life-threatening illness or injury has a unique role to play in their community that goes beyond being the receiver of help from neighbors
active awareness of death, something we'll all grapple with one day, can be depressing. But it can also make each day more valuable. Every word and act can be more compassionate, intentional, and responsible. Those are the words of Jeffrey Betcher, written before he passed away on Saturday. And that does it for today's Cross Currents. Our team includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Christine Nguyen, Lilia Vega, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Jackie Sajiko and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Tumble Down House. They'll appear at Local Edition in San Francisco on Thursday night and at Club Deluxe in the Hate on Friday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
As usual, usual crowd.